This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. When I was 15, I wanted a little extra pocket money. I'd done babysitting, I'd had a paper route, lugging papers around on a sled during a Minnesota winter when temperatures dipped to minus 40 degrees. I was ready to try something different. So I got a summer job at Dairy Queen. It was 7 hours and 15 minutes a day, the maximum an employer could work an employee without giving them a lunch break. It was $1.89 an hour. This was in 1977, and it involved a lot of physical labor, scrubbing floors and tables, hosing down the parking lot, washing pots and pans and equipment, making DQ treats, and of course, serving customers. But always on your feet. If you so much as leaned against the counter when no one was around, the manager would bark, "I don't pay you $1.89 an hour to stand around." I quit after 2 weeks. I joined a temp agency, which, because I typed well, paid me $5 an hour to sit in an air-conditioned office, watch the pageantry of office politics in a new place every couple of weeks, and have a full hour's lunch break and 2 15-minute breaks every day. For me, that summer, temping was awesome. And apparently, I'm not the only one to have felt that at age 15.
So, like you, my first formal sector job was as a temp when I was 15, and I worked for AccuStaff in Baltimore, and I did it because in the 90s, it was still a skill to be able to type.
Yeah.
And I could go get a job and make $7.25 an hour and be in air conditioning, and it was fantastic. It was strange to be a man as a temp doing secretarial work, and it made everyone comfortable, which I was very happy with.
This is Lewis Hyman. He's an economic historian who was born the same year I was doing my teenage temping. When he was doing his 15 years later, I was a freelance foreign correspondent in Southeast Asia. And by then, the novelty for me of the gig economy, in this case, juggling assignments and filing expenses to a bunch of different media organizations, had kind of waned. So it seemed like utter luxury when one of my regular outlets, NPR, offered me a full-time gig as Southeast Asia correspondent. Suddenly, I could just focus on the work. But for many Americans in recent decades, work has been going in the opposite direction, away from the security of full-time employment. You know, the kind of job
that pays us a wage every 2 weeks and gives us benefits. And we all just kind of thought that's the normal way things are going to end up. And increasingly for many Americans, some estimates put it as high as 40%. This is not the kind of work life that they have. They have a life where they cobble together income from various sources. It might be two or possibly three part-time jobs. It could be a normal job that, you know, in the sense of that pays us benefits and wages, but maybe it doesn't give you all the shifts that you need to make your rent. Or even if you have a salary, but you need some extra money because suddenly your partner lost their job or you got sick or had some unexpected bills and you got to drive Uber for a while. So all these kinds of things, it's about this sort of multiplicity of different kinds of work that is being created now.
So Lewis Hyman, who's an associate professor at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations, is writing a book on this phenomenon. This follows really compelling books he's already done called Debtor Nation and Borrow, The American Way of Debt. And I figured if someone can make the history of American debt interesting, I want to sit down with that person and talk with him about what's going on with jobs and the shrinking American middle class and a growing sense among many people of financial insecurity.
So the way that I got from the debt project to the temp project is the realization that a lot of the reason why we're in debt is the change in the nature of work over the last 40 years. So in the post-war, that magical period from 1945 to 1970, thereabouts, wages went up year after year. Median male wages went up about 50% between 1945 and 1970. And since then, they basically have stagnated. They haven't gone up at all. And I say median male wages not because I think we should only worry about men, but because there's obviously other kinds of issues there where more women are entering the workforce. And actually, that's an important story of the temp story. But when people borrowed in the post-war, they were able to pay back what they borrowed. In an economy where you can borrow from tomorrow and pay it back tomorrow. It actually makes everything work better, you know, and this is the entirety of the post-war economy was built on this, in their big fin cars, in their suburban houses, in the retail shopping at the new department stores. It's all predicated on different kinds of borrowing, but they had wages that could pay it back. And when something changed in the 1970s, where suddenly people weren't able to pay back what they borrowed anymore. And it wasn't because people were borrowing more, it was because they were making less money. So if in the post-war, the 1% paid the 99% in wages, after roughly 1970, 1980, the 1% just lent them money. And this is the fundamental dynamic of what's changed in our economy. And so when I started working on this project about temp labor, I wanted to understand, well, what happened from top to bottom in our economy that moved it from a world of stability to a world of insecurity, for good and for bad, so that the people at the top felt liberated from the old bureaucracy. We here in the Valley, we hear all about the innovators and entrepreneurs unleashing creativity and things like that. And for those people, this is great. They can make a lot of money and do amazing things. But for regular folks, it's not so great. They are less able to plan for the future. And even if they are able to get enough money together for their bills, they still feel an overwhelming sense of fear and uncertainty that people in the post-war didn't have to contend with.
This is one of the big changes that came in the past half century that are already shaping this century, in America for sure, but with ripple effects elsewhere. It could be argued that Brexit was in part because of this phenomenon. It calls into question what kind of capitalism is best for a stable, happy, and prosperous society, and how, if we want all those things, we've moved from having a big middle class to having ever more income disparity, more people in poverty, and a shrinking middle class.
My book begins immediately after World War II, just at that moment when we are finally creating what economists call the Great Compression, where inequality that had so defined industrial capitalism since its inception was finally coming to an end, and there was a convergence of people and their wages and income. It was in that moment that the very first inklings of our economy today were born, in the form of the temp agency, which was born in 1947 as an attempt by Elmer Winter, the founder of Manpower Incorporated, to find a secretary at the very last minute. So you have people who look like middle-class women who wear, if you work at Manpower, you know, white gloves. And it's that idea that they're getting money for luxury. How do you justify not giving someone stable work in an era when that's the dominant ideology? And the answer is, they're women, so they don't need to work. That's how they justified it. African-Americans weren't initially a big part of that workforce, but as the 60s wore on, they were. The founder of Manpower, Edwin Winter, was a big liberal. He actually partnered with the Johnson administration to organize temp training forces in inner cities as part of the war on poverty, to sort of train especially young African Americans to have temp labor jobs through something called Youth Power. And then, of course, the day labor forces at the bottom, that is the story of mostly Latino migrants from Mexico intersecting with nascent Black unionists. The most amazing source I found when I was writing this book was the organization called 9 to 5, which is the inspiration for the movie 9 to 5. Wow. And of course, the Dolly Parton hit 9 to 5, which was an office worker organization in the 1970s, started in Boston by two secretaries. They organized all kinds of workers. They organized office workers at universities, office workers in other fields, at finance. And they tried to organize temp workers, and they were unable to do so. And it was too difficult to bring temp workers together to have a unified voice. It was hard to feel like this was the end of the road. I feel like today what's different is that people in the gig economy, the freelance economy, feel like this is how it's going to be. And so we have to figure out what to do. So you have groups like the Freelancers Union, run by Sarah Horowitz, is trying to figure out, what does it mean? How do we provide benefits? How do we provide portable benefits for flexible workers?
Where did the impetus for this come from? I mean, we've been talking about sort of the trajectory of what happened, but how did it happen?
It's a complicated story of how you go from this world of giant corporations that are completely stable and work is pretty stable, and we're sort of fighting the war on poverty and everyone's pretty much behind that, to a world where, you know, work is very unstable. And what's interesting is the interconnection. What happens in the 1960s is two things. One, you have the creation of these large corporations called conglomerates that are based on this belief that bigger is better and you can manage anything. And so they're this weird thing because they're not monopolies. The largest, like LTV, Ling Temco Vought, made missiles and they made basketballs and they sold pork products and they made cement. And they weren't really monopolies. They were just in lots of different areas. And everybody loved them. We poured money into them. And over the 1960s, something like less than 10% of the Fortune 100 remained undiversified, so that our biggest companies all became conglomerates like GE, GM, you know, all those companies. And then in 1969, it was revealed that, in fact, they weren't any more profitable. In fact, they were just burning money and their stocks all collapse. And people have this incredible moment of crisis about management, about big corporations and what to do. And it's into this gap that we start to get this language of shareholder value, this language of, well, we need to just worry about the short term. We need to be small. We need to be nimble. You can see it in the languages of business gurus and consultants where they talk about small is beautiful, right? There's almost this hippie language that's brought to business culture. And there's no way that before this moment, you would have thought that a small organization would somehow be better than a big organization. Because big organizations have economies of scale, they have resources, et cetera, et cetera. Through the 70s and 80s, you start to see the big unwinding of this kind of big post-war corporation. So what we think of as the mergers and acquisition frenzy of the 1980s, you know, like in watching the movie Wall Street or something like that, actually begins in the 1960s. You have the first leverage buyouts, you have the first all these kinds of financial practices. And so this world that is built throughout the post-war of stability, stable work, long-term investment, gets dismantled after this moment of crisis, after confusing, throwing basically the baby out with the bathwater, that conglomerates didn't add any value, but certainly long-term investment in R&D did. And along with the restructuring of the corporation comes the restructuring of work. And so all those executives begin to lose their jobs. Consultants come in. They sort of streamline and restructure. And you can see the origins of downsizing and the restructuring that we all went through in the 80s and 90s begin at this moment. And into this gap, there's a demand for a workforce that can meet the greater fluctuations in the market. So markets become more volatile in the 70s for lots of reasons, like the oil crisis. And people look to temp labor forces to be a buffer between that uncertain market and stable core workforce. And so temp workers come in increasingly as a way to, again, guarantee the stability in an era of crisis and uncertainty. But then by the 80s and 90s, temp workforces are just seen as an important component and they begin to replace regular workers. There's a great unraveling and there's a great forgetting of what made possible the post-war and the post-war life, and forgetting that there's a deep connection between security in our economic lives and security in us as a democratic society, as people who are happy and vote reasonably and don't, you know, worry about the future as much.
And what you were saying earlier about the virtuous circle, I mean, obviously, if you also have people who are working with you or working for you in whatever capacity who have an income which, if not absolutely guaranteed, at least is stable enough that they can continue to consume. They know that they can spend X amount today because they're going to have Y amount tomorrow. Whereas if you don't know if and when you're going to have Y amount in the future, you're not going to spend it in the same way. And then that affects those companies who then say, oh, I can only afford to take on temporary workers because things are too uncertain, too unstable. And it just seems like then you get this downward spiral.
That's exactly right. So that there's a real nice situation where you pay your workers enough to buy your products. So I think what we should do is experiment. And we are doing experiments. So we'll see what happens in Seattle over the next few years. We'll see what happens in all the other cities and states that have the $15 minimum wage, which still is very low, historically speaking. But I think that right now we don't have a scarcity of capital. We have a scarcity of consumers. across lines of class, across lines of education. We are all moving towards this freelance economy, this unstable economy. And for some people, it works out great. If you're a consultant, you can make tons of money in just one day. And if you're an undocumented worker who's working in very dangerous conditions outside of the surveillance of labor law, it's not so good.
Is this sustainable?
This is an important question. Is this sustainable? Well, I think you can always make money by treating people worse.
And until the French Revolution.
Until the people rise up in righteous revolution, right? Which people like us, it will not end well. And I guess my fear is I would like to not live in a revolution in the U.S. So, and this is one of the fears that brought us all the policies of the post-war, that brought equality onto the table, the fears of the 1930s, you know, just 15 years after the Russian Revolution, there were homeless encampments in Washington, D.C., very similar to the homeless encampments that are now under the I-280 in San Francisco. And so they created policies to provide work. They created policies to invest capital in new industries to create new jobs for millions of people. They created tax codes that redistributed from the rich to the poor. So if you talk to Republicans, they always talk about how great everything was in the 1950s. Well, the top marginal tax rate in the 1950s was 93%. 93%. You know, it's a very different economy when we agree as a society that the very wealthiest should give back to the poor and rebalance the scale somewhat.
But there was always an undertow from at least some conservatives against the New Deal, the idea that there should be this redistribution of wealth. My goodness, this was like socialism, if not communism. And that sector of conservatives in the U.S. are pretty happy with the fact that now the 1% have what they have, and they continue to push for more policies that will help concentrate wealth even more.
I think there are some people who are extremely wealthy and happy with the way things are going. But I think there's also some extremely wealthy people who are very concerned. You know, it doesn't really matter if you have $1 billion or not, if a mob comes to your house or that democracy fails. So the real question is, what do we do as a society to rectify that, to create systems that allow us to have the freedom of work? You know, it is nice to be able to just work whenever you want to work. And I mean, it's nice to freelance. It's nice to not have to show up to a cubicle from 9 to 5. So we shouldn't romanticize the post-war either, right? It's terrible to work on an assembly line. So the question is, how do we bring what's best about that world, where there's at least some minimal level of safety and security, into our economy and use that to support all these entrepreneurs and creatives, and also just everybody else that isn't an entrepreneur and isn't creative? I certainly am not an entrepreneur and I'm not creative. I'm a tenured professor. And
well, there's some creativity involved with that.
There's a little bit of it's creativity, but you know, I've chosen a career path that's very safe, that isn't available even to other professors. So 70% of faculty teaching in America is done by adjunct professors.
And that's also a newish thing, right?
It's totally a newish thing. It's in the last 15, 20 years. And so what went from, you know, you hire an adjunct to teach some weird class that, you know, maybe nobody has on this faculty or their friend visiting from somewhere, has now become the sort of normal of what higher education is. And so this is true for many areas. There's often a two-tier system of labor in America, even for the so-called freelancers, the consultants. It's very different to do that kind of thing when you have a pile of money in the bank than if you're living hand to mouth.
Right. What was it that drew you into economic history?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I came from a working class family. My dad was an exterminator and He lived a precarious life, and he was in and out of work, and he died very young because he didn't have access to healthcare. He would go from ER to ER to ER. And I sort of very personally felt this precarity in my life growing up. Now, on the other hand, my mom, she was a government worker, and she worked as a healthcare worker in the VA hospital. And she had sort of, you know, government benefits and things like that, and that stability. And so I think a lot about their two lives, a life of precarity and a life of stability. But my mother also found her life really boring. As a healthcare, she liked that she was serving veterans, but at the same time, it was still very tedious and boring. And eventually, her job was replaced by a machine, and it was totally de-skilled, and you could do chemical assays by pressing a button. So I went to college, and those kinds of issues of power and class sort of informed my questions. And I think growing up in Baltimore, from Baltimore, it's hard not to see that race and capitalism are deeply interconnected.
Yeah.
And so I think it's that sort of seeing race and gender and class intersecting with the sort of financial institutions that surround us.
Power, class, race, and money. They are all interconnected in ways that Americans haven't always paid close attention to. Because Americans have long liked to think that this is a nation where everyone's equal, or at least there's equal opportunity. So if you're not getting ahead, it's your own fault. But that wasn't the argument during the Great Depression.
Once I built a tower to the sun, brick, mortar, and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Like we were talking about before, there was a New Deal that, you know, empowered workers, that regulated the economy, that brought about higher levels of taxes. But there was another New Deal that is now forgotten, what I like to call the other New Deal, that was about investment. And that New Deal was broadly embraced by businesses and has been written out of our history books to a large degree. It's the New Deal run by this guy named Jesse Jones, who was a Texan banker and journalist. He founded the Houston Chronicle and real estate developer and banker and sort of a jack of all trades, successful in all those trades, unlike, you know, most jack of all trades. And what he did was he ran something called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which you might remember from a history test, but not really remember what it's about. During the 1930s, Wall Street had just a huge pile, and by Wall Street, I mean investment banks, commercial banks, had just a huge pile of money just sitting there. So Citibank and Bank of America, they didn't know where to invest their money. What Jones did was that he said, hey, I will take your money, I will give you a reasonable rate of return, and then I will put it into play. And so either directly by RFC borrowing or by creating specialized investment vehicles, intermediaries, things like the Federal National Mortgage Association, or what we now call it Fannie Mae, which acted as an intermediary between people who wanted to buy a house and people who wanted to invest in housing but didn't necessarily know each other. That brought us something called suburbia, which, whether you like it or not, it houses millions and millions and millions of people and brought people out of tenement housing that was decrepit and bad and into bright, airy new housing. That is the most well-known of this, but there's other things too, like the Rural Electrification Administration, which set up electrical cooperatives throughout the country. So what had been largely a darkened country, and the 90% of rural Americans didn't have electricity in the early 1930s. So it went from about 10% in the early 1930s that had electricity to about 60% by the end of the 1930s. And this was done by, again, capital being invested through this organization. And then the least well-known of all these is something called the Defense Plant Corporation that was founded to defend us against the Nazis in World War II and to ramp up industrial production, but was fundamentally about investment in edgy technology. So things like aerospace, things like aluminum extraction, synthetic rubber were all brought to scale as industries through the investment through this Defense Plant Corporation. And so through mechanisms like this, the other New Deal brought about an incredible new vitality in the economy. And so as we think today about, I mean, there's been so much discussion of that big sloshing pool of money moving around the world, right? And one of the reasons why we are always being solicited to borrow more money is because nobody knows where to invest this capital. There's so much capital out there, and they don't know where to put it. It's hard for us to imagine as normal people, but for the big players in the global economy, the pension funds, the hedge funds, the bazillion billionaires, they're desperate to find an outlet for capital. And right now, the best outlet for capital is our home mortgages and our credit card loans. And until we provide them with better outlets, like we did during the 1930s and 40s, to invest in aerospace and more cutting-edge technology and industries that employ millions, it's going to be very hard to get our economy going again. And fundamentally, this is how capitalism has to work. It has to be a virtuous cycle where capital comes into businesses, is invested, and creates new jobs.
Well, and if you're living in a world with the gig economy, where people, even if people adjust, even if people get through the period of disruption and say, okay, I've figured out a way to make a living, it takes a little more effort, a little more energy than having a job does, but that's okay, I can do it. Perhaps there are even advantages to it. But I don't feel any loyalty to any particular organization. And I'm not going to invest that much of my energy or imagination or creativity in any specific organization. Nor am I going to work with a team of people over time where we get used to working together and having a synergy of our ideas that could lead to breakthroughs. So don't we lose something pretty big in the process?
Yeah, I think that you have to have a long-term perspective to come up with truly innovative ideas. You have to take risks. There have to be failures. It's not possible if you're having one-off transactions with one another. You know, there is a way in which the gig economy is great for clear-cut projects, like code me this website, write me this brochure. But it's bad for investment in really innovative ideas and long-term development of new ways of doing things. That said, we also have been doing that very badly in our regular W-2 corporate economy for the last 40 years. And that's because even in that economy, you can have very short-term thinking. So we don't have the Xerox, you know, park. We don't have the Bell Labs that we did of the post-war that created all the wonderful technologies. The only places where you have that these days are at relatively monopolistic tech companies like Google or Facebook, or places where they're so insulated from the market because they just make so much money that they can invest in crazy schemes.
So if past is prologue and you look at times in history, both in the United States and in other countries, where there have been bursts of creativity and sustained innovation, what do you think should be happening now that isn't? Mm-hmm.
I think for me, as I think about what ought to be done, I think back to the Homestead Act in the 19th century.
Okay, a little background. The Homestead Acts, and there were several of them, one after another, gave settlers a chunk of land, 160 acres at first, then twice that and even more, if they would stay on that land for 5 years. Almost 10% of the total U.S. land mass was given away free in this way, most of it west of the Mississippi, to about 1.6 million people. Okay, back to Lewis.
So I think back to ways in which the state empowered ordinary folks to strike out on their own and take a risk, but gave them the tools to do it. What would be the Homestead Act for the 21st century? In education, in minimum levels of support, people talk a lot about guaranteed basic income, allowing Medicare to happen for everybody so that people could go out and try things out, and a lot of them would fail. And that's okay. It's just that we want people to fail and not end up destitute. And I think that's the trick.
Guaranteed basic income. So let's talk about this. What would that look like in the United States?
So there's lots of different models for the guaranteed basic income. The easiest one is everybody gets X dollars a year. Right now, we have a version of it in terms of our tax credits for the very poorest so that they get tax credits to raise them up to a minimum income for the year. A version of it that's a little more aggressive would be just sending everybody a check every month, so everybody gets $2,000. Now, a much more aggressive vein of this would be saying, well, every time somebody issues a stock, they take risk. But we also take risk on them as a corporation, giving them this artificial legal structure so that they can carry out their enterprise. Well, we should be compensated for that risk. Maybe so every time a stock is issued, another stock goes into a holding company that is jointly owned by the American people.
Huh.
And so instead of it being about taxes, it could be about ownership and the joint ownership of all capital. So that if you want to take this very artificial form of organization, that's fine. You can do that. You are now immune from all kinds of social obligation in a lot of ways. But then we get a taste. And to me, this is the most exciting version of this, sort of thinking about, well, how do we cut out the state? How do we not make it about welfare, right? How do we make it more about a sort of collective enterprise?
I can already hear the protests coming from the right about how this sounds way too much like socialism.
It sounds a lot like socialism, but then they would have the option to just have partnerships. There's other kinds of forms that don't involve being a corporation where you can still retain all the profits. It's just if you want to take this corporate form, where, you know, you lose all personal liability for it and you push that onto society and make us responsible for it, I feel like I should be compensated somewhat.
It seems to me that behind a lot of the issues that you've been looking at in recent years is kind of a struggle for the soul of American democracy. You're looking at ways in which not just money has been redistributed, but power has been redistributed. And what you're talking about right now is redistributing power back to people who are too easily exploited. If they're minimum wage workers or if they're in the gig economy, they have to pay their bills, so they have to just kind of suck it up and do it. And employers can say, this is what I'm offering, take it or leave it. If they have the $2,000 a month, if they have a share in the value that's created, they have options. They can do what's offered, or they could walk away and look for something else. And I wonder if that's not threatening to some of the 1%.
I think it is definitely threatening to the 1% who have made their money by stomping on other people. There's some of the 1% that have made their money by bringing us free products like Google. People like that would be much more open to this vision that they want to live in a democratic society. They want to empower people. Right now, only about 30% of American adults have a college education. A lot of people are just struggling to make ends meet. And if we live in a society where just a few people are allowed to be creative and thoughtful and the rest just have to drudge through, we're not going to have the skill sets we need to really overcome what's coming. And for me, it's a do or die kind of situation that we have to make a capitalism work for all of us, not just for a few people. Capitalism is resilient, and it can be remade in lots of different ways to work in different ways.
Throughout human history, there's only been this very thin sliver of time in which people anywhere could count on having a job, a regular income, benefits, etc. Certainly, that's also true in the United States.
Absolutely.
It's been, what, 100 years, 150?
Not even. I mean, really, since urban America, since the 1920s.
Have we just gotten spoiled?
There are those. Jeff Cowie just came out with a book called The Great Exception that says basically this period roughly from the 1930s to the 1970s was just a great aberration and it's never going to happen again. And I kind of disagree. I think it's a choice that we made. So we made a set of policies that allowed that to happen. And then we forgot basically that we had made that choice. We started to treat it by the 1960s. As a set of natural features of capitalism. You know, people in the 1960s actually worried about what would happen when we had too much leisure time, right? They worried about what would happen. We only had 4 hours of work a week and we had all this time to just do whatever we wanted to do. And it's laughable now. And it's
not
also
realizing that we were a nation of workaholics.
A nation of workaholics, and also just on the cusp of the great stagnation from 1970 to now.
So you're an economic historian.
That's right.
And the economy tends to go in cycles.
That's right.
Long-term cycles as well. Have we ever been at a point like this before? And also, second question, you can answer the two of them together, is this very specifically an American experience, or is this what happens to mature economies, where they just sort of, that there's a period of having a middle class, and then you move into something else, or at least you're challenged in terms of how to continue to have a sizable middle class?
So I think nobody really knows, right? So we like to draw straight lines. And this is part of what happened, that we drew straight lines in the 1960s and 70s. We thought things would just keep on keeping on the way they were. And then suddenly it didn't. And there are those who argue that now is to return to average, that this is what it's like, and we should just suck it up. I tend to think that actually the average is what we used to have in roughly 1200 AD. Because for most of human history,
where everyone lived to be 28.
And 28, and we were all covered in mud, and we lived in hovels. That's actually the normal human condition. And that what we're living under now is the result of a capitalism that's only about 500 years old, a process by which extra money can be invested in organized production and sometimes new technology to produce more productivity, which then is distributed throughout society. This is a very novel thing. It's only existed for a few hundred years. And, you know, it's something that has to be carefully husbanded, something that has to be fostered and cared for. So I think you asked me about the cycles. There are cycles in the economy. You can see it in the most basic product cycle, so that when a new product is introduced, like a phone or a new kind of shoe or something like that, some kind of product, there's a period where there's tremendous profits. for a few years. And then profits begin to wane. And this is just called the product cycle. And if you add up all the product cycles, this is what the economy is. And so when you read people who are really down on capitalism, like this guy Karl Marx, Marx says, in the long run, all profits go to zero. And basically, it's this idea of the product cycle at the largest possible scale. For the last couple hundred years, through technical innovation, we've managed to create new products. We've managed to create new opportunities for investment that create above average returns so that the rate of profit has never fallen to zero. It's not a question of what's natural or unnatural. There's no natural because we're people and we make choices. And as long as we can keep coming up with new ways to invest money profitably, everything will keep going and probably get better.
And how does immigration and the enforcement or lack thereof of borders fit into that?
Yeah, so this is an important question. And the book I'm writing is a lot about that. It's a lot about flexible work from top to bottom. And at the bottom, you have the undocumented. So the book traces out this deep connection between the legal guest worker program of the post-war period, the Braceros program that brought Mexicans to America to work in agricultural labor, how they transitioned into first construction labor and then electronics labor, so that Silicon Valley, the semiconductor business, back when Silicon Valley used to make something, hundreds of thousands of undocumented workers were in the electronics industry doing the dirtiest, most dangerous work. And they sort of set the pace. There's a reason why electronics was the first major industry in the U.S. that wasn't unionized and that paid so little to its workers. And it's not because of undocumented workers, but because of the ways in which undocumented workers were brought into this industry by the employers, right? And so on the one hand, you don't want people brought into the economy who are beyond labor law, who are afraid, who can be exploited easily, because that's not good for anybody. That's not good for them. That's not good for American citizens. But on the flip side, you do want to bring in hardworking people that want to do great work and want to be part of our society and probably in a more inclusive way. In the long run, it's people that create all the value. And so figuring out how to welcome people into America in a way that makes them part of our society as Americans is probably the only option going forward and the smart option if you want to have a rapidly growing economy. People who think that America is white and you're born here and it's your blood tie, and it's a certain vision of America that looks like other nations, but I think America's special. And what's special about it is that it has this abstraction to it. We're people who are ruled by law, who make our laws, who come from all over the place, and we decide on what that American experiment is going to be. And I think that people who want to be a part of that, I say, come on down and let's make it happen.
So it sounds like in this century, in answer to the question, whose century is it related to work? It depends greatly on how we structure our future in terms of enabling people to do work in the gig economy where they still have some stability, some assurance that they'll have an income, that they have choice, that they'll be able to continue to participate as consumers and as citizens in a democracy. I mean, that they feel invested in the system.
I think we always have choices about whose century it's going to be. And we can make choices that empower people and create a more inclusive, more democratic society. Or we can make choices that might seem a little easier, but ultimately will destroy the society that we've worked so hard to create. Mm-hmm. And it's fragile and special, and we need to preserve it.
I couldn't agree more. A lot of Americans feel angry or anxious these days. But the answer isn't to build a wall and keep out immigrants. Immigrants can help an economy grow, and they have since the birth of the United States. America is at its best when it's not in a defensive crouch or in a mode of cocky aggression. It's at its best when it's dreaming big in ways that empower all of its citizens and inspire people around the world. Thoughts, comments? I'd love to hear them. Send me a message on Twitter at Mary Kay Magstad. That's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. You can find the print version of this episode, along with related links, on our webpage, pri.org/century. And while you're there, you can also check out any and all of the other episodes of Whose Century Is It? This is episode 23. Or you can subscribe on iTunes and on most other podcast apps. If you prefer to stream, you can find us on SoundCloud and Stitcher. Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join us next time.